6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the
Thank you for listening to A Public Affair. It is Wednesday, June 8th, 2016. It's a beautiful day. And I'm your host, Karma Chavez. Thanks, Andrew, back there. Doing a great job today. Thanks also to Sarah, the fantastic producer who's with us a little bit longer. And, of course, thanks to Kathy out front answering phones. And I'd also like to thank Norm Stockwell, who's been texting here with me, but he's in the studio. Hey, Norm, how's it going?
It's good. It's good. Thank you so much for having me in here. And thank you, Karma, for all of your great work.
Now, of course, Norm needs little introduction to any listener, but let me offer some anyway. So Norm serves as WORT's operations coordinator. He's been working at the station in music and news programming since 1983. In addition to working as a journalist in the U.S., Cuba, Nicaragua, and Mexico, he's been involved in the collective management of two Madison institutions that you probably know if you've been here a while, Lakeside Press and Mifflin Street Co-op. He's also the former director of the Old Town School of Folk Music in Madison. Norm's been a regular host of this program and others since 1989, and he's covered a host of issues like the murder of Jesuits in El Salvador, the Gulf War and its aftermath, pro-democracy movement in Nepal, the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas. He's had incredible guests like Noam Chomsky, Holly Near, Johnny Clegg, Sarah Diamond, Howard Zinn, many, many more. The list goes on. He, as a journalist, covered the World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle and Cancun, the FTAA meetings in Miami, Democratic conventions since 1996, Republican conventions since 2004, and a whole host of other things. He's active in a variety of organizations like the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, the Grassroots Radio Coalition, Indie Media, among others. He also has reported for and been interviewed by things like Free Speech Radio, Democracy Now!, Air America, and also the Cap Times, Alternate, among others. And as I mentioned, he's also the editor, co-editor of the book Rebel Reporting, John Ross Speaks to Independent Journalists, which you can get by giving us a $50 pledge. So there's a lot more I could say about Norm, but I just thought, you know, he's always behind the scenes here, sometimes interviewing others, and I wanted to tell you a bit about him, and I'm really excited to have him here today. So, Norm Stockwell, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you so much. It is unusual to be on this side of the microphone, I have to admit.
Yeah, I had that experience the other week, and it is a little bit strange, but I'm really glad you agreed to do this. I think it's, for me, this is my second-to-last show. You're heading out in a couple of weeks to your next adventure, so it seemed appropriate, I think, to have this conversation together. Though I've not been here nearly as long as you.
I will say I'm not leaving town.
Sure.
And so I will continue to volunteer here at the station. I just won't be here quite as many hours during the week.
Because it would be hard to be here more hours than you are on any given week. So we're glad you're going to take some time off. But officially, your attentions will be turned elsewhere toward the Progressive magazine. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But I'm actually interested, how did you start with WORT?
Well, as you noted, I was when I first came to town, I ran a folk music school here. It was on East Johnson Street, up above the Whole Earth Grocery Co-op. And we brought in visiting artists to do workshops and concerts. And then we had a number of local people who were teachers at the school, some of them still here in town as WORT volunteers. And the different classes that we had were basically they were group lessons. They were semester based, so it was sort of in sync with the UW calendar. But I started getting involved with folk music programming here at WORT, and we tried to remember the date, and it's gone into the gray edges of memory. It was either August 17th or August 24th of 1983. I did my first radio program with Ken Rainier, who's now the producer of the Access Hour, but back then was the host of the Wild Hog in the Woods radio show. It was a folk music program on Thursday mornings. And back then, folk music was only an hour and a half.
Okay.
As opposed to now when it's 3 hours.
Yeah.
So we had an hour and a half of folk, and then we had an hour and a half of international right after that. And Ken invited me on to be on one of his shows and showcase some different kinds of music, and that was my first foray into the world of WORT. I had very, very briefly played around with the idea of radio quite a bit earlier, but I hadn't never done a regular radio program until that day.
So were you trained as a journalist at that time?
I was, before I moved to Madison, I was an archaeologist.
All right.
And then from there, I started doing marketing for scientific research publications, which I did for a while for the Northwestern University Archaeological Program. And that kind of led me into freelance graphic arts. And so I was doing that when I first came to Madison, along with truck driving.
Okay.
So, no, I did not have a background in radio or journalism. Full disclosure, I still don't have a BA. So,
well, you know, you have a PhD in life, Norm, which is in many ways all that matters. There's no way around that for sure. So it's interesting to hear how you came. And I'm wondering, I mean, all these years, you must have a ton of amazing memories, but if you had to pick out one or two of the highlights of your key best memories during your time at WORT, what would those be?
Well, let me frame it a little bit differently, which is a lot of people say, well, how did you get to be doing what you're doing today? And I'm the operations coordinator of WORT. I have been in this role since June 12th of 1995. And how did I get there? Well, I started out doing folk music programming. From there, I kind of drifted into news and public affairs. I did my first news story on the Martin Luther King birthday holiday of 1985, when Madison announced the naming of Martin Luther King Boulevard. Over here in downtown Madison, that street used to have a different name.
Mm-hmm.
We don't remember it anymore. I don't remember it anymore. But I prepared a news story about that, and they aired it on the evening news. And I remember at the time, one of the other volunteers here was shocked when they heard my name on a news story, because they always thought of me as a folk music person. From there, I started doing programs of a public affair. At that time, Jeff Hansen was the regular host of a public affair. He did all the shows, all five shows.
5 days a week.
Yeah. And he later went on to other things in radio. He went to Wisconsin Public Radio, then he went to the state of Maine, then he went to Houston, Texas, then he went to Seattle, where he's been the program director at KUOW in Seattle for the last decade or more, and he actually just retired out there this last year. Anyway, so Jeff invited me on to start hosting some public affairs programs, and one of the first reports I did was an investigative report on the murder of the six Jesuit priests and their housekeeper and her daughter in El Salvador, which took place November of 1989, and did a very serious investigation of that, which Rob Mayberry, who was a WORT News volunteer at the time, helped me out with a bunch of that, and we got a lot of interviews and put together some very important radio pieces that I'm very proud of. And that later became part of my 20th anniversary, actually 10th anniversary, then 20th anniversary, and then 25th anniversary of coverage of that story. And so the most recent piece I did was an extended article in the Tico Times, a Costa Rican newspaper, which includes transcripts of our early interviews from 1989, along with more recent interviews done in the subsequent decades. So that was a piece that was very important to me. In 1991, actually August of 1990 was when we had the inklings of the upcoming Gulf War. and we had a meeting here. In fact, it was in this very room where you and I are sitting. A bunch of the different peace groups in town got together, and we had a meeting of WART volunteers and these different peace activists talking about how will WART cover this coming war, the war that's going to that's threatened to start in January of 1991. So we planned out our coverage, and at that time, WART's news department happened to be in transition because Jeff Hansen, who had been the public affairs host and news director, had moved on. Sharon Seibart, who was the had been the morning news director and then became the news director for the station, was on maternity leave, so there wasn't actually a body in the news department, and so I was brought in for the sum of $10 a week to coordinate coverage of the impending Gulf War in 1991. And so I spent January and February hosting one day a week of a public affair. We had other hosts at that time doing other days, and then coordinating our other coverage of that.
So it's a fascinating journey to imagine. I think this is what you're speaking about too, is one of the great things about community radio is you get hands-on training, maybe not qualified, you know, in the official sense, and it doesn't matter. You become qualified as you go, and you're able to produce such amazing programming. And definitely your work, I think, shows that without a doubt over the years. We're talking with Norm Stockwell, who has been at WRT since 1983, and he's heading to the Progressive, staying in Madison, but he's going to be the publisher of the Progressive. So we're getting a little history about WRT from Norm today, having a conversation about what WRT has meant to him, what he's seen, these kinds of things, getting that kind of information.
You know, just this past weekend, of course, with the tragic death of Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
We had a nice piece on the WART website that Stuart Levitan and I put together. I also did one for the Progressive Magazine, and I found this article from August of 1969, where it turns out that the FBI wiretapping of Martin Luther King was actually first revealed to the public accidentally during the testimony in the trial of Muhammad Ali for refusing induction into the military. Muhammad Ali refused induction. He was tried in federal court in Houston, by the way, near where you're headed.
Yeah.
And in that trial, they brought in an FBI agent, and under oath, he testified about a phone conversation that they had a tape recording of between Muhammad Ali and Martin Luther King.
Wow.
And that's where it emerged that actually they had been tapping Martin Luther King's telephone, the FBI had, since October of 1963.
Jeez.
And totally illegally. Later they tried to say that Robert F. Kennedy had authorized it as Attorney General, but there's some question about that even Robert F. Kennedy himself, for his death, said there was question about that. So it's a very interesting story, but it came out of the Progressive, and in that article, the discussion about civil liberties and about tapping of telephones in 1969 resonated exactly with what Edward Snowden was saying today about NSA surveillance of
Wow.
everybody's private lives. So, you know, these stories don't go away, and the Progressive has always been on the front line of bringing those news stories.
And Norm, I'm wondering, I look around this place and I often joke when I bring guests in, especially out-of-town guests, about the 1980s style decor that we still have. But what was WORT like in the early 80s?
Well, we moved into this building in the fall of 1982. And that was, my first experience with the station was in 83. At that time, the studios weren't finished yet. And so we were broadcasting out of this studio here. That one was still under construction, and of course on the radio that this and that
studio
doesn't
A
mean anything.
Studio
but yes.
B.
Then in the newsroom downstairs, we had a row of reel-to-reel tape recorders and manual typewriters. And that was how we produced the news here. You type a thing on the typewriter in all caps, because that's the way it was done in those days. And we had an AP wire machine, a machine that received the AP news, and you would do what was called rip and read. That is, you'd, the thing would come spitting out, you'd rip it off, you'd run upstairs, and you'd read the news. We had reel-to-reel tapes in the studios as well, and that's how all of the pieces were created. We would take, you'd record a telephone interview, and then you would go back and listen through it and mark that tape with a grease pencil, and then you'd line it up very carefully, and you'd take a razor blade and you'd diagonally cut that bit of tape, and you'd hang these little strips of tape next to you until you had the whole story assembled, and then you'd very carefully tape them together with this either white or light blue splicing tape, and then you'd put all that together on a reel, and sometimes you'd put leader tape in between the segments. The host would be sitting in here reading the news, and the engineer would be there, and they'd play the first segment of tape up to the leader tape, then the host would read the next bit, then they'd play the next segment of tape, and that's how news was put together. In 1987, 1987 was the Watergate hearings, and we had just recently gotten a satellite dish. Not Watergate, Iran-Contra, sorry.
I was like, wait a minute.
Iran-Contra hearings. We had just recently gotten a satellite dish, and so we broadcast, we were the first station in Wisconsin to broadcast the Iran-Contra hearings live. After that, public radio started doing it later and so on, but we were the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry Bensky of Pacifica Radio and his producer Bill Wax were sitting up in this little tiny area in the gallery in the house where they were sort of propped on these wooden chairs. And they had their little transmitter that they could broadcast this stuff to us via phone lines and then satellite. And they also had a cassette recorder. And every time there was something interesting, Bill, the producer, Bill Wax, who was a great jazz producer, by the way, as well, would be sitting there, and he would be recording those little clips. And then Larry would real quickly have to put together summaries, and Bill would be handing him these cassettes with these little clips, and he'd pop it in the player, and he'd play that, and that was part of the broadcast. Well, we were sitting here at Ward. I was the engineer for these, and we'd be broadcasting. We wiped the deck clear, and so a lot of programs that would normally be on were preempted by the live hearings. And we'd be sitting there, and we would be recording it as it went on these reel-to-reel tapes. And you never knew when the hearings were going to end. So sometimes, they would end at 4 o'clock. Sometimes they would end at 3 o'clock.
Mm.
And I'd have to have a stack of jazz records ready to go because at that time we were still doing everything on vinyl. The CDs didn't exist yet.
Right.
CDs had just barely been invented in 1984, and we didn't have them here in the station. In fact, our first CD player at Wart, the rule was that only the chief engineer could use it. So if you wanted to play something from a CD, you'd have to get the chief engineer to play it for you, and you'd record it onto a piece of reel-to-reel tape so you could play it back on there. But we recorded these Iran-Contra hearings live, and then at the end, I would have a certain amount of time, whatever it was, an hour or two, to assemble a summary by listening through these reel-to-reel tapes and doing what we call electronic editing, which is instead of using the razor blade, you just back the tape up and you mm-hmm. find the spot and you mark it, and then you record the next
mm-hmm.
thing. Put together these half-hour summaries that we would play at 6 o'clock for the people who weren't able to listen all day long.
Jeez.
So that was the technology of WRT in the 1980s.
So in some ways, we've come a long way, baby.
We have. We first started, we got our first computers in the late 80s here. They were XT computers. In fact, the very first computer the station got had an 8-inch Bernoulli drive, one of these big 8-inch floppy disks. Not a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk, an 8-inch floppy disk.
Jeez, I don't even remember
those. These didn't have hard drives. Hard drives didn't, weren't in common use at that time. The first hard drives were probably 10 megabyte hard drives,
sure.
If you think about, now you're getting a 16 gigabyte flash drive for $12 at the office supply store. So so we had our first computer, and it ended up, it was leased. I think it ended up costing about $30,000 or something over the life of the lease. But in the newsroom, we started getting these donated XT computers, and we would hook them up, and we would do a little work to try and network them together as first an Apple Talk network that we got. And too much technology talk, I know.
Yeah, no one cares about that part.
We got a subscription to PeaceNet, which was this experiment started out of California, this organization that became known as the Institute for Global Communications, IGC, and they had a series of these computer bulletin boards, and one of them was called PeaceNet, there was GreenNet, and these were ways of getting information about what was going on all around the world. And then we started using that for our Third World View news programming that I was working with at the time. This is, you know, starting 88, 89. And also Chuck Winant, who was another WART volunteer and briefly on our board of directors, he had a lot of contacts with prisoners, people who were political prisoners in the United States, particularly a group called the Resistance Conspiracy folks, but and one particular prisoner, Ray Levasseur, who he still keeps in touch with, who's out now. But we started this service where we would download, using PeaceNet, these news reports, including like firsthand, you know, communiques from the FMLN in El Salvador and from the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and so on. And then I developed this little WordPerfect, which was a computer program at the time, WordPerfect 5 or whatever, 4.2 template. And we would download this text, pour it into this template, and then we would mail these. We'd print these, and we'd mail them to the prisons. And then they were handed from prisoner to prisoner and circulated around these prisons. I actually found one a couple of nights ago. I was digging through an old box, and I found one of these newsletters that we had produced. But these were basically getting firsthand information about global struggles to people inside maximum security prisons all through the internet in its early days.
Yeah, I mean,
before the existence of the World Wide Web.
It's incredible to think about that, and that all of that can be facilitated through, you know, through right here. I mean, and this also, I mean, this points to so many of the neat things that have been able to happen in this space. And you mentioned a number of people, and I'm wondering if you talk a bit more too about the folks who've come and gone from here. Some of the people that maybe now we might actually think of their names as household names, and they got their starts here.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, we tragically this year lost Chris Ward, who was a great host here on WORT for many, many years. He did Public Affair. He did he hosted the Breakfast Special for a little while. He did film reviews. He was he had a rock show for a little while, and Chris went on to a great career in the U.S. State Department, the Agency for International, or no, U.S. Information Agency, excuse me. He passed away this year, but I do have a great Chris Ward story that I have to share at this moment. So, Chris, was very, very smart and very creative and very well read. And he ended up getting on the television program Jeopardy. And over the course of, several episodes of Jeopardy, he won, I forget, $45,000 and a car or something that. And, you know, that's great, and it's a great story, but it made him legendary in civil service. Because here you have all of these government bureaucrats that are making actually pretty low wages when you think about it. And this guy was like their star because he had you know, won all this money, and it was, you know, what they could only dream of, well over a year's salary, you know, in a couple episodes of Jeopardy. So Chris was posted in Japan for a while. He was posted in a couple different parts of Latin America. And in 1998, I was in El Salvador with then Madison Mayor Sue Bauman and City Attorney Eunice Gibson and Mark Pocan was on that trip, and it was great delegation. But we went to visit the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador. And as we walk in the door, this harried bureaucrat comes running out, And he says, which one is Mr. Stockwell?
Oh, my.
And I kind of, you know, because we hadn't, like, announced ourselves. And I sort of waved my hand. And he says, are you here for yourself or the radio station? And I said, well, both. But I'm not taping the conversation, if that's what you're worried about. And he said, oh, okay. He says, I'm so-and-so from the U.S. Information Agency. And I said, oh, I said, you must know my friend Chris Ward. And he had this sort of look of you know, this honorific look in his face. He says, oh, well, of course I've heard of him. And after that, he was very friendly and, you know, ushered me in and showed me around.
Well, thank God Chris won Jeopardy.
That's
so
right.
It helped you to get into the embassy there. And I mean, there's others. Maybe,
so, yes. Okay. So yeah. Let's talk about a few other people. So Michaela Majoun, who is the longtime host of The Breakfast Special, went on to a great career in radio in Philadelphia. Tracy Wall, who was a Wart News volunteer and is now producer of Morning Edition, I think it is, at public radio nationally. Mm-hmm. And she was producer of Weekend, All Things Considered, for a long time. John Hamilton, who was another Wart News volunteer, who went on to work for Democracy Now!, for Link TV. He's now back again working on special projects with Democracy Now! John's story is great. He was a young guy in North Carolina, grew up in a, you know, university family, but not politically radical in any way. And he started listening to Democracy Now! On the internet. And he said, this is something I'd like to do. So he went on the internet, and this is probably mid to late 1990s, and started looking at all the community radio stations in the country. And he picked WORT as the one that he thought would be the best place to get his start in radio. And
wow.
So he moved from Durham or wherever he was in North Carolina, he moved to Madison, Wisconsin in order to start volunteering at WRT so he could learn radio and eventually ended up getting to work at Democracy Now!
Wow. Well, I just wanted to, as you were talking, I wasn't just checking my email. The someone, a listener sent us a, do you want me to just, Andrew sent us the an image of a 10 megabyte hard disk that was selling for only $3,398. So
that's right. That's right. Well, I wrote a little piece. I'll share it with you at some point. It was about the internet comes to WRT, where I tell some of these stories of the development of technology here and how we grew. You know, WRT, it's really interesting because we're a little tiny community radio station, right? And yet, we have always, because we think these problems through really well, I think, in a really sort of consultative, collaborative way, we have always been on the forefront of technology. So we were actually the first radio station in Madison to have a fully uncompressed digital STL. What does that mean?
Yes, what does that mean?
STL stands for Studio to Transmitter Link.
Okay.
So back in the old days, the way a radio station got its signal from its studio to its transmitter was through phone lines. And they were just copper phone lines that were dedicated to that purpose. And then after the breakup of AT&T, that sort of got more difficult because then you had to go through a bunch of switches. And so stations started moving to new technologies. We used a microwave transmitter, but we had to hop over the UW hospital because there wasn't a clear line of sight. So we had a relay that was on top of the building over here at just down the street, the Triangle, where the Triangle Ethnic Fest is held. And we had a relay there. And then we got this digital microwave link, and it was what's called uncompressed. That is, it wasn't crunched. It was pure sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so WRT installed that in January 6th of 1999 and became the first radio station in Madison to have a fully uncompressed digital STL. So even though we're a little tiny radio station, we're doing all these interesting things. Another similar story in 1991 during the Gulf War. We had a, you know, Ward is well known around the country and around the world because of the coverage we have done. And there was a Madison resident who was stationed in Saudi Arabia in a town called Jubail, Saudi Arabia, and he was working for an oil company. He wasn't stationed there because he was a contract employee. And he called us to report on a missile strike that had happened in this particular part of Saudi Arabia that wasn't getting any press at all anywhere. The focus of the U.S. press was what was happening in Iraq and Kuwait and so on. And so we taped that interview. We broadcast it on the air. And then I also called CNN. And I said, hey, we've got this story about this missile strike from this Madison guy who's over in Saudi Arabia. And I played them the tape and so on. And the next day, I just happened to be watching the CNN coverage press conference with Pete Williams, who was the Pentagon spokesperson at that time. And he's talking about this and that. And the CNN reporter raises their hand and says, what about the missile strike in Jubail, Saudi Arabia?
Mm.
And you can see this sort of deer in the headlights look. It's live TV. You know, how did they know about this? He's thinking. And he says, well, yeah, there was something that happened there, but we're not quite sure about it yet. And
right.
So it was obvious that here, a little tiny community radio station that probably had, you know, at that time, a budget for the entire news department, including salaries of less than $20,000 a year,
right,
is scooping CNN and getting a question asked at a national press conference that's televised across the world on CNN.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really is just a testament. Again, we're talking with Norm Stockwell, who's heading from WRT to The Progressive as the new publisher there starting in July. And so we're just doing a little history lesson talking about WRT. One of the things that this question I've been waiting to ask you, now we're nearing the end of the hour, so I want to make sure to ask, but at some point the FBI wanted WRT's donor list?
This is a great story, and I should say, you know, I can tell these stories all day long, and I've got a lot of stories, and I'm more than happy to share them. I love sharing them. I love talking about WRT. So in February of 1996... the Club de Wash, which is a wonderful bar and restaurant complex that was right around the corner from us, burnt to the ground. It was a center of Madison's gay and lesbian community. It had some wonderful bars in there, as well as the center of Madison's alternative rock community with a great rock club that showcased many, many famous acts. And it burnt to the ground, and there was a lot of speculation, you know, was it arson? They brought in special investigators to try and investigate this. Well, it turns out we got a threatening letter here at WRT right at the same time.
Hmm.
And that threatening letter was one of these, you know, it was where it was written all the way to the edges of the piece, the 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and it was every other word in a different color. So the person used two pens, red, blue, red, blue, and wrote this. And this was before red and blue were political party designations. Anyway, they wrote red, blue, and they wrote this long, detailed, you know, basically saying something to the effect of, we got the gays and we're going to do it to you too.
Whew.
So I took the letter to the fire investigators who were working on this, the Club de Wash fire, and I said, you know, here's something that we just got delivered here at the station, and you better take a look at it. And then they turned it over to the FBI. So the FBI came here to the station and interviewed me about this and asked, you know, were asking questions about the station and so on. And at one point they said, well, why don't you give us your donor list so that we can check it against our list of known suspects.
Wow.
And I said, oh, I'm sorry. We're actually prohibited by federal law from sharing our donor list with anybody, but why don't you give me your list of known suspects and I'll check it against our donor database. And they walked out.
Wow. Of course they did.
So WRT does not give its donor list to anyone, including the FBI.
Actually, Norm, I guess I had a million other questions I wanted to ask you, but, you know, that's how live radio goes. But I do want to ask you, as you're looking back on your career in community radio, looking forward, moving to The Progressive, what is the future, in your view, of community radio?
Well, I mean, I think the future of community radio is still very, very strong. I think that the, you know, when television first came out, they said it would be the end of radio. When the internet first came out, they said it would be the end of radio. But in fact, sometimes the delivery mechanisms have changed a little bit. You know, we talked about the uncompressed digital STL, mm-hmm. but the idea of a radio station where people can gather together and cross-pollinate, cross-fertilize, you know, share ideas with each other to develop this thing that is the whole, that is WORT, that's irreplaceable. You know, it's a blogger sitting in their basement typing, you know, a post for the internet is not the same as a community newsroom full of young journalists getting excited about something and sharing ideas with each other and bouncing things off of each other. And similarly, a lot of commercial radio now has become, you know, this sort of computer programmed, you know, let's market to this narrow target audience, because what they're really about is selling advertising. And what happens at a place like WRT is you have local people who are passionate about a particular topic, a particular kind of music, a particular type of culture, and they're sharing that with the listening audience. So you have this real connection to a local person in your community, and that is not cannot be replaced by the internet. There's no, you know, we won't name all the different mm-hmm. internet sources for music because there's several of them out there now.
Sure.
But none of those will replace having a DJ in the studio who's not only playing those songs, but talking about the connections, talking about the influence, talking about how this song came from that song and this performer influenced that performer, and then showing it to you by mixing those things together in mm-hmm. in a radio program. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes community radio vibrant and viable, and it will survive long past, I think, a lot of the rest of the disrupted media out there. And, you know, people say, you know, mm-hmm. so I'm going from community radio to the Progressive magazine. I'm not going away. I'll still keep volunteering here at WORT. But I'm going from one disrupted legacy media platform to another.
Right to another, yeah.
But somebody else I was talking to said, you know, it's also a lot like trains.
Mm.
That, in a sense, trains are the technology of the 19th century. But they're also the technology of the 21st century.
Sure.
And we're moving now, maybe not so much in Wisconsin, but
yeah.
as humanity, we're moving towards the notion that trains are a way to move people and information
yeah.
and commodities much better than cars. And so I think that in some ways these legacy media platforms of community radio and a print magazine like The Progressive are sort of like the trains of now. We've take this old idea, this mm-hmm. radio, FM radio, obviously in its current form, starting around 1948, AM radio before that with Marconi mm-hmm. and Fessenden and Stubblefield, mm-hmm. But that technology now moving forward into the 21st century in whole new ways. And the way that we use the web here at WRT is a really good example of that, where you're providing all this value-added content mm-hmm. to listeners, and you're providing stuff in multiple different platforms so that people can access it wherever they're at. The Progressive magazine is also moving in the same way, and that's mm-hmm. one of the things that we're moving towards in the future, is using the web in new and better ways. One last thing about the future of the Progressive is, you know, here we are in Madison, Wisconsin, a magazine that started over 100 years ago, 107 years ago here in Madison. We're uniquely positioned to talk about what's happening now with the right-wing attack on working people and mm-hmm. all of the social programs of the last century. We're here in the Midwest. We're going to talk about that to a national audience.
I'm Karma Chavez, and this is A Public Affair.